So if you happen to be looking at the screen, the question is perhaps a little overstated as it relates to this text, but I thought it would get your attention. And I came up with that title back in November of last year when I was preparing and laying out the text. So I didn't have any particular thoughts about what it might relate to in contemporary terms, but we'll give some consideration to the practical implications of that, but we'll also give some consideration to the specific textual significance. Does it really matter what we eat? That is a question that is on people's minds constantly these days. But that's not the major emphasis, just so that you know. Last time we were reminded of the continuing expansion of the church beyond Jerusalem and Judea. And it was moving to the west near the Mediterranean Sea. The focus had returned to the ministry of Peter while Saul was back in his hometown area getting prepared for his future ministry and having some whatever impact he might have had while he was there. But it was particularly a retooling of his understanding in preparation for the ministry that he was going to be having. So then the focus comes back to Peter. And the ministry of Peter will continue to expand, and even such that it will include the Gentiles, as chapter 10 is going to be pointing out of the book of Acts. Of course, Peter would need some encouragement to move outside of his comfort zone and beyond his common prejudices. And believe it or not, we may have our own prejudices. Actually, I know, that sounds crazy, but it's true. And probably in areas and in ways that we hadn't even thought about. But we want to think about some of this. So let's consider what we can learn from this passage and some of its implications for our own day and our own context. So as we look at the text, the first thing we want to look at is dividing the text out. We see here there is a responsive heart receives more light. And verses 1 and 2 of Acts chapter 10, we read, "There was a certain man of Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household, who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always." So you get a little bit of an idea of something about this particular person. So I want to point out an observation. Someone who fears God may not have all the truth. Is that a fair statement? Probably. Maybe inevitably. We don't have all of the truth. And if that such was the case, as we think about Cornelius here. In a sense, this scene is the turning point of the book. And not only that, it has great significance for us, as we will see. From here, the gospel will fan out in all directions to people across a wide variety of geographical areas. And, of course, Paul's missionary journeys are a record of this, how that's going to be taking place. The episode concerning Cornelius is obviously very important since there are three lengthy references to it in the book of Acts, in chapter 10, chapter 11, and chapter 15. There's reference there as well. It deals with an important issue concerning the mission that the Lord gave the disciples. And that issue is how the Christians should carry out that mission in view of the obstacle of Gentile uncleanness. The Gentiles were considered unclean. How can you possibly bring the gospel to them? So Gentiles were ritually recognized as unclean, and they could communicate ritual uncleanness to the Jews according to the Mosaic law, mainly because they did not observe the Jewish dietary distinctions. That's why the food thing is associated with this scenario. And so this obstacle kept Jews and Gentiles separate in society. It was kind of an ongoing thing. Now there's four things that are going to be stressed in this conversion story here. First, the Christians initially resisted the ideas of evangelizing Gentiles and of accepting them into the church apart from any relationship to Judaism. The point being, in their minds, you had to first become a Jew and then you could become a Christian. Was that the case? That's what this is going to be dealing with. Second, God himself led the way in the Gentile evangelism and acceptance, and he clearly showed his approval and expectations. So the issue that they're going to be having is, we've always done it this way. And how can we possibly, how can God change his mind? How can this be different? I mean, if you're in that scenario, it's hard to break out of it, which we will see throughout this whole time frame. Was very difficult. Third, it was Peter, the leader of the Jerusalem apostles, whom God used to open the door of the church to the Gentiles rather than Paul. That has significance because it brings it right back to the central beginning point and to show that this is not something that, oh, this crazy Paul guy dreamed up. It was something that God dreamed up right at the outset. So it's really important that we see this point of connection. Fourth, the Jerusalem church accepted the conversion of Gentiles apart from their associating with Judaism. That's what's the key issue here. And this was a very important event for the continued growth of the church, and it was not an easy transition for the church to make. It was a challenge, and we'll see evidence of that continuing throughout much of the church's early history, and even today, some people have some issues. So there was a regular garrison of soldiers in Caesarea. So when we think about this particular area, it had some significance. Caesarea stood on the Mediterranean coast. It was about 30 miles north of Joppa. It was formerly named Stratos Tower, but Herod the Great built it into a major seaport, and then he renamed it in honor of Augustus Caesar. And Augustus was his patron, who was the adopted heir of Julius Caesar. So Herod the Great basically modernized the city. He made it the provincial capital of Judea, and that's where Pilate lived. And he built a magnificent harbor. And if you've ever been there, you'll also notice that there is a major aqueduct that is still there that you can see that points back to the time frame of when this was originated. So at that time, it was a major Roman seaport for the region, and it was the most important center for Roman government and military activity. Therefore, to find a centurion like Cornelius there is not unusual. And the name Cornelius was a common Roman name. It was not particularly different. It was just normal. Centurions were non-commissioned officers of the Roman army, and each one commanded, can you guess, 100 soldiers. Centurion, who would have figured that out? And had about the same level of authority as a captain in the U.S. Army, if you're able to put that together. A cohort contained 600 soldiers, and Cornelius's Italian cohort had some noteworthy connections with Italy, and that's why it was noted that way. Another interesting observation is that every reference to centurions in the New Testament is positive. If you go back and look at some of those, like Matthew 8, 5 to 10, Matthew 27, 54, Matthew 50, or Mark 15, 44 to 45, Acts 22, 25 to 26, and Acts 23, 17 to 18, and 27, 6, and 43, there's a bunch of them, and they're not putting them in a negative light. They're putting them in a positive light. And these men were the backbone of the Roman army. And what's interesting is that the the disposition, the way that Cornelius is described, is not very different from the centurion that's referenced in Luke chapter 7, verses 1 to 10, who came to see Jesus, or who sent people to Jesus. Technically, he was recognized as someone who loves our nation and built our synagogue. So there's some comparison there. Cornelius represents a new type of person to whom the gospel had not gone before, as recorded in the book of Acts. And so Cornelius was not only a Gentile, but he was a member of the Roman army, and that army was occupying Israel. So the Jews would have a natural disaffection for him just because of his occupation, and yet there were several that were referenced in a positive way because they had a good disposition toward Israel and toward the people, and they were friendly to the Jews. So it's interesting to note that the first Gentile whom Jesus dealt with during his ministry was a Roman centurion, and he believed also, going back again to Luke chapter 7. So in response to that man's faith, Jesus announced that many would come from among the Gentiles to join the Jews in responding. If you go look back to Matthew 8:11, so there's an interesting parallel there. Cornelius was recognized as a God-fearing man, and that was sometimes somewhat of a technical terminology that was used there. He lived a moral life because he had a fear of God, a recognition of God as God, and as well as other members of his household, and he is recognized as having generosity to the Jewish people, as well as having his continual prayers that were evidence of his respect for Israel's God, which, you know, apparently there were some who did that. This was one of those. So his relations with God and people were admirable, somewhat comparable to what we might think about the designation of the great commandment in Matthew 22:37-39. Shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he seemed to have that kind of disposition. And he had not become a full Jewish proselyte. In other words, he was still uncircumcised, but he did pray to the God of the Jews. And so it's assumed that he was not yet saved until he heard the gospel, because Christ had already come by this point and had died for sins by then, and so his response to the gospel would have been expected. And he had interest, and when he had interest, God brought more light. And I think that is a helpful way to think about how it works even today. So then, pressing on, verses 3 through 6. About the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God coming in and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he observed him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? So he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. Now send men to Joppa and send for Simon, whose surname is Peter. He is lodging with Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea. He will tell you what you must do. When the angel who spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his household servants and a devout soldier from among those who waited on him continually. So when he had explained all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa. Or if you were in Israel, it would be Yafo, if you look on a map equivalent to that time frame. Someone with a responsive heart can expect more light. So a vision of an angel got the attention of Cornelius. So there's a reference here to the ninth hour. That would be about 3 p.m. That would have been the Jewish hour of prayer. Also referenced in Acts 3:1. So Cornelius may have been praying at that time. And so here we have again another situation where God was preparing, as we'll see in just a little bit, God was preparing two individuals To be able to meet, but preparing them independently by giving them a different vision. Cornelius and Peter will receive one just like Paul or Saul and Ananias had previously in Acts chapter 9. So Cornelius here saw an angel, and he references the term Lord here, which would be a common respectful address equivalent to what we might use as sir. So it was not an acknowledgement of being the Lord, but a lordly response, or just a respectful way of responding. So Cornelius undoubtedly felt some sense of awe when he saw this supernatural visitor. I mean, I don't know about you, but angels popping up would sort of get your attention, and I'm sure it did in his case as well. His responsive heart had been recognized and referenced, it's pointed out. And God had noted that Cornelius had a responsive heart through his prayers, that was Godward, and through his alms, that was manward. So there was both toward God and toward man. And now he was, because he was responsive, God is giving him more revelation, more light, more truth. And so Luke seems here to be suggesting that the prayers and the alms of this particular Gentile were accepted by God, perhaps in a way of thinking, in lieu of sacrifices, which he would not be allowed to offer because he couldn't go into the temple. So there's a sense in which this was an alternative way of responding, but he wasn't expected to because he was a Gentile as well. So there's another way to look at it. So it's all part of the beginning to break down the barriers between the Jews and the Gentiles, which is what is in process here. He was given instructions for what to do next. God told Cornelius to send some men to Joppa for Simon, also known as Peter, who was staying there with another Simon, the tanner. And it's interesting because the location of where this was taking place was in Joppa, which is near, right on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. And it's assumed because the process of tanning required a fair bit of water that he may have had to be there in order to have access to that. So more on that in a bit, perhaps. He responded with instructions to do as requested. Cornelius immediately sent two of his servants, probably to assist Peter, and also a spiritually devout military aide to encourage Peter to come, to have some sort of visual sense of authority with the presence that was there. Not just one person, but not just two persons, but three, so that we have a contingent that would sort of get his attention and recognize that this is something important. And so it's also assumed that these individuals were also God-fearing individuals as members of the household, at least one, two of them would have been, as is noted earlier, and would likely have been in sympathy with Cornelius's purposes and concerns here. So again, the point is that there was a divine appointment for some very specific purposes that were going on here. And that purpose had to do with some being saved now, coming to faith in Christ, and many others being saved later as a result of the lesson that would be learned here. That is, Gentiles can be saved, and you don't have to become a Jew first. So most of us who are believers today can thank the Lord for the lesson that was communicated and learned on this occasion because it affects us directly. And we ought to be particularly grateful for the message that's communicated here in terms of what it means, not only to those particular individuals at that time, but for all of us, with rare exception. So then pressing on, a restrictive conscience receives new insight. So So the next day, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up on the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. Then he became very angry and wanted to eat, but while they made ready, he fell into a trance and saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. So that's kind of an interesting thing. A practical object lesson was needed to communicate truth. God doesn't hesitate to come up with interesting and creative ways of communicating. The Lord used Peter's hunger to bring him a related message. It's interesting the time frame and the circumstances that were involved here. Now, it's understood that most Jews prayed twice a day, but particularly pious Jews would pray at noon as well, the sixth hour, which would be a third time of prayer. It's referenced in Psalm 55:17 and Daniel 6:10. And so Peter may have been praying at that time, but maybe more for the focus being on the success of the gospel in Joppa, what he had just experienced there, as opposed to simply it being a normal routine, though it could have been that as well. Some have suggested because of the aorist tense that's used of the Greek verb prosukamai here, it suggests that Peter may have been praying about something definite rather than just in general, and that's why they suggest maybe it was with regard to what had already taken place Joppa there. And he may have gone up on the rooftop for privacy, maybe for the fresh air, or I would say probably for the view, because it's sitting by the ocean. I'm kidding about that. Peter was hungry, and so food was on his mind. I mean, that would be pretty normal. We have that. As a matter of fact, what time is it? Oh, it's almost time to be thinking about food. Some of us are very time-oriented when it comes to food. I would include myself in that. So then he's going to have this vision. And the word for vision here is horama. And you can see the word panorama. We get our word panorama, diorama, all related to that. And so his hunger played a practical part in this. Because when you're hungry, for some reason, food pops into your head. And sometimes, I don't know if you've ever had this, but I've had it when I've been on a significant bike ride, and it's getting close to time to eat, and I'm thinking about, okay, what am I going to eat when I get home, because I'm getting really hungry now, and I kind of have it all worked out. And so maybe that was what was going on in Peter's mind as well. And we have to remember, we are holistic beings, and we are significantly affected spiritually and mentally by physical conditions. So when we're tired, cold, hot, hungry, sleepy, or in pain, it affects our whole being in a variety of ways, and perhaps some more than others, but yet we all know that we are affected by that and need to take that into account. The Lord knows our limitations and our needs, and he can use them to get our attention as he chooses, which he did in this particular case. The message displayed a wide variety of creatures. There was this sheet-like container. Some have speculated maybe similar to an awning on the roof or a ship's sail. We don't have any idea, really. But it uses that picture of a sheet-like, which was full of all kinds of animals, clean and unclean. Acts 11:6. The issue of unclean food was the basic one that separated observant Jews like Peter from Gentiles. That was a big issue. And the Jewish law distinguishing between the clean and the unclean is found in Leviticus 11, and it indicates what can and cannot be eaten for the Jews. It didn't apply to everybody else, but it did apply to them. And that made a huge difference in their thinking as to who they could associate with and how and when and if. Then looking at verses 13 through 16, and a voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And a voice spoke to him again the second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." This was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. What is it with Peter in three times? I mean, that seems to be the common recurring thing. I think that's where they got the idea of three strikes and you're out. Maybe not. The object lesson was meant with concerned resistance. Peter was commanded to eat any of the presented creatures, and he protested this command rather strongly, though somewhat politely. It's interesting, Ezekiel had a similar situation where he was asked to do something that he perceived as objectionable, and the Lord modified slightly. He could cook with animal dung instead of human dung, so I'm sure that made a big difference for him. But he had an objection. He said, "What are you asking me, Lord?" And so Peter was kind of feeling the same way. It's assumed that what he heard was the voice of Jesus. Doesn't specifically say that, but seems like that may have been. And Peter may have remembered and recognized the voice as that of Jesus, because he would have been familiar with it. And he may not have understood, or maybe even not remembered, but he may have eventually remembered what Jesus had declared previously, that all foods were clean. If you go back to Mark 7, 18 to 19, so he said to them, "Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods?" In Romans 14:14a says, "I know and am convinced by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself." So there was some recognition of that. Of course, Romans was written after this. Peter responded with a clear negative to the request. He said, "Not so, Lord," which is what we would call an inconsistent contradiction. You don't say, "Not so, Lord." Doesn't really fit. Yeah, Peter's response was very consistent with his, what we would consider, impulsive personality and his former contact. He's been known to do that. He had said no to the Lord before, and we might add, got in trouble for it. His reaction to this instruction reminds us of Peter's similar extreme reactions on previous occasions, and he was speaking from personal conviction, because he had been taught and trained and ingrained in his head that there are certain things you don't eat. That's just the way it is. And you just don't do anything different than that. That's what he's known all of his life. Also interesting to note the contrast between Paul's response, or Saul's response, when the voice from heaven came on the Damascus Road. He didn't say, "No, Lord." He said, "What do you want me to do?" It was not negative. So Peter was told that the common had been cleansed. So Peter's Jewish cultural prejudices were overriding the Word of God in his thinking. And as we know, old habits die hard. And for this reason, God repeated the vision two more times, just so it could get through our thick skull. Peter's thick skull, like the rest of us, so that he could be sure that he understood correctly. Let's see, once, twice, three times. Okay, I think I'm getting the picture, but did he? Takes a little bit. So the message of the that was communicated here may have reminded Peter of an occasion on the beach back in John chapter 21, where the Lord also had to say something three times to kind of get it through his thinking. The message of the vision is that the disciples are to receive the Gentiles because God has cleansed them through the gospel message to them. So the particular application here had to do with nullifying Jewish dietary laws for Christians, and that was consistent with the remark that was pointed out in Mark 7. But Peter was soon to learn that the range of the vision's message extended much more widely. It wasn't just that the foods were presumed or designated as clean, no longer unclean, but the Gentiles themselves are now acceptable and can be responsive objects for the gospel. And it causes us to wonder if Peter made a connection. I don't know how much time he had to think through all of this, but if he made the connection to where he was, Joppa, and if he remembered Jonah being called to go to the Gentiles from Joppa, and Jonah jumped on a boat and went the opposite direction, and Peter was at a place where he needed to either say, yes, Lord, or no, Lord. Well, he started off by saying, no, Lord, but sometimes it takes a little bit for it to sink in. So God had also called Jonah to carry a message to the Gentiles, and now Peter found himself in a similar position. So was he going to be responsive? Was he going to get the point? Did he need to be thrown into the water first? Or was he going to be responsive? But what he should recognize and what he did recognize was that this command of the Lord would free him from any concerns about going to a Gentile home and eating whatever might be put before him, however hard that may be. And I can only imagine that that is something it's like. I was going to say it would be something on the order of my wife eating squid. It's like, nah, I don't think she would do that. I tried it once. That was enough. It was the texture. So it would be a short step for him then to recognize that Gentile food was cleansed, to realizing that the Gentiles themselves were also clean, and the Lord himself had declared it to be so, and now he had to rethink a lot. It's not easy when you've thought a certain way all of your life and then have to rethink something. For any of us who have ever done that in any particular areas, you know what I'm talking about. But it's necessary. And so we, in light of this truth, need to watch out for those among us who are Christians who suggest that they observe the dietary restrictions of the Mosaic Law. Because that was not the expectation, that was not the requirement. It was, they were freed from that. That was simply a modern form of legalism. Well, we know there's a lot of confusion today about what we should eat. And it turns out there are as many things that are myths or more than all those things that are true. And the truth is that most of what we have been told is fabricated, unsubstantiated, overstated, or just false. Regarding what is healthy and what is not, with rare exception, most of what we have been told is wrong. We've been hoodwinked. We have been told so much. Now, this might come as a shock to you, but the so-called health food industry is a multi-billion dollar industry that will say whatever it takes to sell their products. And we have been duped by the media, who have been complicit because they don't check things out. They don't have the wherewithal to do so. And by advertising, that sounds good, but is rarely true or accurate. The actual science does not support it. And all you need to do is check out some basic biology and physiology. And if you understand the makings of the functioning of the cell and how it works and how a lot of these things work, then we realize that, you know, our bodies are fearfully and wonderfully made, and they can handle much more than we think if we would just let them. And then there's the thing about bread. Who tells us to eat bread? We don't live by bread alone. And then there's the gluten thing. There are people who have problems with gluten, celiac disease, and such. But most people don't. And yet we've come to think we need to, because that's the fad at the moment. And there's a lot of the stuff that's labeled health food that is actually worse for us than just normal food if we would just eat in proper balance and avoid the deficiencies that come when we leave out things that we should not be leaving out. And then there are questions about things like organics. Are organically grown produce, are those better? Are they safer? Do you really want to know? I'll give you the short answer. No. You're paying more for stuff than what you ought to. What about supplements? Only take what your doctor prescribes. Otherwise, you probably should not. And then there's references to things like antioxidants and omega-3s. Those are things that have been way overblown. And then we have this fear of GMOs. They're not to be feared like we've been told we should. And then the fad diets. And then the horrors of pesticides. Turns out those are actually a really good thing if you just recognize that there are limits as to how much and where they can be used, and what little does get on anything that we eat, our bodies can handle. Because there's a thing that's called the the basic principle of toxicology. How about that? Is the dose makes the poison. The dose makes the poison. You eat too much of anything, it'll probably kill you, or could. Don't try it. But that's something to keep in mind. But anyway, this is a bit of a digression, so I'll not go too much further. But unless you've been specifically diagnosed with a medical condition or a deficiency or an allergy, just eat a good balanced diet in proper moderation. Enjoy it. All the rest of that stuff out there is probably not correct. We need a good variety of vegetables and fruit and whole grains and most anything else in moderation, a good balance of nutrients, and, oh, in our research, exercise. Who would have thought? That is all far more important. So avoid all the expensive, worthless, supposed health food stuff out there. And if you want to avoid one other thing, energy drinks. The stuff that has caffeine in it, that is what has been pointed out is what is killing the young people. It's giving them heart attacks. Avoid the energy drinks. Everything else is fine within moderation. And remember, we're all made up of chemicals. The chemicals that are out there, we can process most of them. Just eat within reasonable limits. Susan is a fact checker. She has become the commensurate fact checker. She checks things out. And she found a resource through Creation Ministries International. It's essentially a textbook that someone who is professor of food and nutrition and that sort of thing, was in the process involved in checking out all of the claims that are out there. And we've heard lots of claims. There is a resource. There are resources, actually probably several and well-documented that are available. If you're interested to know what it is, you can text or email me. But basically, just follow the biblical diet. The biblical diet is everything is fair game. Just eat within reasonable limits. That's it. Unless you're diagnosed with a particular problem, just eat normal. And we'll all be better off. Anyway, that's the lesson of that right there. So now, back to the text. That was just my excursus, by the way. Okay, Acts 10, 17 to 20. Now, while Peter wondered within himself what this vision, which he had seen, meant, behold, the men who had been sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate. And they called and asked whether Simon, whose surname was Peter, was lodging there. While Peter thought about the vision, the Spirit said to him, behold, three men are seeking you. Arise, therefore, go down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them. The message and request of the lesson caused much analysis. As Peter was processing the message, the men came to him, and he was trying to sort through this. He wasn't really sure what was going on. He probably didn't understand what the vision meant, but it's not surprising given all that he had been told throughout his lifetime, as we have also been told things. The common and the kosher issue was so thoroughly ingrained in his Jewish mind, it was hard for him to imagine that God could be asking this of him. And you can imagine that would be the case. Did I hear this right, or is it my stomach being hungry that is messing up my thinking? But he saw the vision. It was indicated three times just to make sure it came through. So it's hard for us to think differently about things that are familiar and common and have been a part of our experience for a long time. So we understand that. So while Peter was pondering this particular subject and being rather perplexed in mind, the messengers came and called out below, and so the timing was significant since Peter had just seen this vision. It was fresh on his mind, and so he was told to go with them without reservation. And he was supernaturally informed by the Spirit that the three men were seeking him, so he went with them, and he had recognized there should be no objection for him to be able to go with these individuals, though otherwise, prior to this, he would have had objection, most likely. And so he was free to enter the house of Cornelius without any misgivings. Then verses 21 through 23, then Peter went down to the men who had been sent to him from Cornelius and said, yes, I am he whom you seek. For what reason have you come? And they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man, one who fears God and has a good reputation among all the nation of the Jews, was divinely instructed by a holy angel to summon you to this house and to hear words from you. Then he invited them in and lodged them. And on the next day, Peter went away with them, and some brethren from Joppa accompanied him. So the message of the lesson now received an important context. So now he's seeing the picture kind of coming together. Why was this message given to him at this time? So Peter met the men sent by Cornelius, the Roman soldier, and he came down the roof, probably by a stairway, which may have been on the outside of the house, which would have been common. And then he met them, and he was told of the virtue of this particular Gentile soldier. They would have wanted to communicate in a good light so that he would be encouraged to go with them, but they may not have known that he was being prepared separately and divinely as well. So Peter provided normal hospitality for his visitors. And once he learned what it was that they wanted, then they stayed for this brief period of time before then venturing out. It's also been pointed out there's an element of irony here because Peter had been staying at the house of a tanner, and a tanner would have been considered unclean because he's dealing with, you know, dead creatures. And but I would see it maybe as part of a transitional movement, a preparation that is being made. But as we see, this was again a huge transitional movement in the book of Acts and in the history of the church. And it would take time and a lot of discussion, a fair amount of disagreement, and even a church council, Acts chapter 15, in order to decide what the expectations for Gentiles is if they come to faith in Christ. And so it would be an ongoing issue. Do the Gentiles need to become Jews before becoming Christians? And there are still people who are confused about that and try to mix Judaism and Christianity, and I think there's a problem with that. So hopefully we know that the only requirement for anyone to become a Christian is believing in Jesus as the Savior, as the Christ. And that we can share this truth that Jesus is our sufficient substitute sacrifice for sin when he died and rose again in our place. And Jesus showed himself to be God's Son, our Savior. And we simply need to trust in him. And that no one is excluded as common or not good enough, since Jesus paid it all for anyone who believes in him. That's the hope that we have. That's the message that is communicated in all of this. And we can take that to heart and pass it along.